So we're going to be going over metabolism, focusing on the gastrointestinal system and the liver. And this comes from chapter 43. Hepatitis. This is the inflammation of the liver, and it's caused by various different reasons. So there are five different types: A, B, C, D, and E. Each different type has similar manifestations, but they're transmitted differently, and their course, disease course is also different. Let's start talking about hepatitis A. So hepatitis A it causes a mild flu-like illness along with some jaundice. It's not chronic, but it's transmitted through fecal oral route. So it occurs through either fecal contamination of food or from drinking contaminated water. Contributing factors for Hep A includes poor hygiene, improper handling of food, crowded situations, and poor sanitary conditions. So this type is going to be amongst majority like your homeless population. Risk of transmission occurs before the symptoms even start to appear. So if it's found in the feces, it takes about 1 to 2 for symptoms begin to start, and at least 1 week after the onset of illness. So hepatitis A, the way it is diagnosed is that the blood is tested for hepatitis A IgM, so the antibody for hepatitis A. And hepatitis A IgM, that will indicate acute hepatitis. Hepatitis A IgG, immunoglobulin, is past infection, so they'll have a lifelong immunity with IgG. So the best way to prevent hepatitis A is by vaccination and hand washing. Hepatitis B, this is more of a bloodborne pathogen, so it's transmitted in several ways. The most common way is perinatally, so mother to baby, percutaneously, so IV drug use, accidental needle sticks, or via small cuts on the mucosal surfaces and exposure to infectious blood products, or other body fluids. Is detected in almost every body fluid, so semen, cervical vaginal secretions, and saliva. It's in lower concentrations in those, but it's still detectable. Each antigen will appear depending on the phase of the infection and immune response. So there are three different types of antigens, so the surface antigen, the core antigen, and the E antigen. So the surface antigen, that's our marker of infectivity. So that lets us know infection is present. So if the surface antigen is present for longer than 6 months, that will indicate chronic hepatitis B. Hepatitis C. So it can be either acute or chronic. If it's an acute, they are usually asymptomatic, but with chronic, they'll have some liver damage with that one. Acute is mild in presentation and it's kind of hard to detect because of the patients being asymptomatic. The most common mode of transmission for Hep C is by using contaminated needles and equipment, along with injection drug users and unprotected sex with multiple partners, especially among the men with men sex. So Hep C was also common back in before 1992 because blood wasn't tested for hepatitis C. So people back in the day used to get Hep C from getting blood transfusions. There is a 15 to 20 year delay between infection and manifestations of liver damage, which places the patient at risk for long-term effects of Hep C. So they could have been exposed years prior to, but because it's been all these years in between, they're more susceptible to having other chronic conditions to develop, and it's kind of harder to heal from. Hepatitis D, which is also called Delta virus. So this one is uncommon in the United States. It can survive on its own. It cannot survive on its own. So it has to have another hepatitis in order to be present. So it requires the Hep B surface antigen in order to serve as its outer shell. So it needs another hepatitis in order to be present. You can only get hepatitis D if you're infected with hepatitis B, and there is no vaccine for it. Hepatitis E is exactly similar to hepatitis A. It's an RNA virus and it's transmitted the exact same way. It's more commonly seen in the developing countries such as India, Asia, Mexico, and Africa, and is generally acute and self-resolving. Now we're going to focus on the pathophysiology of hepatitis. So in viral hepatitis, hepatocytes, the liver cells, they're the target, and they're altered through either direct action of the virus or a cell-mediated immune response to the virus. So if it's an acute infection, a large number of hepatocytes are destroyed, causing liver dysfunction. So you'll have issues with bile production, coagulation issues, blood glucose instability, some issues. They'll have issues with detoxification and processing of drugs, hormones, and metabolites. Liver cells can regenerate in normal form after the resolution of the infection, so they can go back to normal if it's corrected. With chronic, it's more insidious and silent, so you really don't see it coming until the damage is already done. So with chronic, it'll cause fibrosis and it'll progress to cirrhosis. So manifestations of the complement system activation, they'll have cryoglobulinemia, which is an abnormal amount of protein in the blood. So, clinical manifestations. During the acute phase, this lasts about 1 to 6 months. They'll have right upper quadrant pain, and this is from the liver being inflamed. So the patient may have decreased sense of smell, and they'll find food repugnant, meaning it doesn't taste good. Smokers usually have a distaste for cigarettes, and during this period, the patient is at their maximal state of infectivity, so they can easily infect during the acute phase. As far as the physical examination, icteric means that they're jaundiced, so that's the yellowish discoloration of body tissues, and it's the result of a change in bilirubin metabolism or disruption of the flow of bile into the hepatic or biliary duct systems. The patient will have dark urine, light or clay-colored stools, or pruritus. Convalescent phase of hepatitis, this begins as jaundice starts to disappear. So it'll last from weeks to months, and major problems in this phase are malaise and that these patients are easily fatigued. They still may have hepatomegaly, but the splenomegaly will subside by the time they get to this phase. I'm focused on a few of the complications. Acute liver failure. So this is the rapid onset of severe liver dysfunction in someone who has no history of liver disease. The most common cause of acute liver failure would be acetaminophen, other drugs such as isoniazid, sulfa-containing drugs, and anticonvulsants. So acute liver failure is often accompanied by hepatic encephalopathies, and that's whenever they have cognitive changes. That's usually the first sign of acute liver failure. They can also have renal manifestations, and this will be due to dehydration, hepatorenal syndrome, or acute tubular necrosis, also ATN. During this condition, the bilirubin is high, the PT time is prolonged, and both the liver enzymes AST and ALT are both increased. We have listed the diagnostic studies for acute hepatitis. Table 43.4 talks about the different viral hepatitis tests. You don't need to know those, just briefly look over them. But I want you to focus on table 43.5 with knowing the diagnostic findings with acute hepatitis. So this will come in handy for whenever you have patients that have hepatitis as a diagnosis. So knowing what would be out of whack is important. So the alkaline phosphatase, this will be moderately increased. The AST, which is aspartate aminotransferase, this is increased in the acute phase, but it decreases once jaundice disappears. And the same applies with the ALT, which is alanine aminotransferase. Prothrombin time is going to be prolonged, of course, because you're having issues with the liver. So their clotting factors are going to be out of whack. Albumin can be normal or it can be decreased. Just kind of depends on if the patient is having volume issues or not. Total bilirubin, so it'll be increased to about 8 to 15 milligrams per deciliter. Urinary bilirubin is going to be increased, and urinary urobilinogen will be increased at least 2 to 3 days before jaundice appears. So the FibroScan, that is just a non-invasive assessment to look for liver fibrosis. It helps determine the degree of liver fibrosis. And FibroSure uses results of serum tests to help also assess the extent of liver fibrosis. Interprofessional care of hepatitis. So just like we were saying, each phase, acute and chronic, they have similar initial care treatments. So we want to make sure that they're receiving adequate nutrition, so they're on a well-balanced diet and taking the proper vitamin supplements. We want them to rest because with hepatitis, their metabolic demands are high. So resting gives them a chance to let the liver kind of rest some. So we want to alternate periods of activity with them as well. Drug therapy. So for hepatitis A virus, there is no specific treatment for it. Hepatitis B, we only do drug treatment when it's severe. And for chronic hep B, the drug therapy focuses on decreasing viral load, liver enzyme levels, and the rate of disease progression. So the goal is to prevent complications with hepatitis B. Hepatitis C virus, they use direct acting antivirals, and table 43.7 just talks about those. So just briefly look over those. For supportive drug therapy, we want to give them antihistamines for the itching, and we'll give antiemetics for nausea. So we usually use promethazine or ondansetron. So now we're going to talk about cirrhosis. Cirrhosis, we know, is a complication of hepatitis. So it results in the replacement of liver tissue by fibrous and regenerative nodules. So as you can see the image here, it kind of shows you how it go from having a healthy liver to cirrhosis. So the most common causes of cirrhosis developing is chronic hepatitis C and alcohol-induced liver disease. So there are two causes, biliary and cardiac. So a biliary cause includes primary biliary cirrhosis and primary sclerosing cholangitis. Cardiac causes are results from long-standing severe right-sided heart failure. So now this is just a little patho map to kind of show you how cirrhosis develops and the patho behind it. So of course we'll have something that'll cause liver inflammation and the different signs and symptoms that they'll appear with the liver being inflamed. So then it goes from being inflamed to being necrotic. So once it becomes necrotic, we know that the body tries to accommodate for that change. So everything else, they'll have all these different signs as a result of that necrotic tissue being in place. And so if it continues to be necrotic, of course the liver will scar and it'll have that fibrotic tissue. So trying to get blood flow through that liver will cause portal hypertension, so the increase in that blood flow within the portal vein system. and then it will lead to these conditions. So it also kind of shows you how you'll start to have apparent issues with the lab values during the liver necrosis part of the patho. Clinical manifestations of cirrhosis. So during the early phase, the patients are usually unaware, and if they are symptomatic, they're usually fatigued and they have an enlarged liver. So during the late phase, this is a result from the actual liver failure and portal hypertension. So jaundice. This is a result from decreased ability to conjugate and excrete the bilirubin. So the liver can't get that bilirubin metabolized. So this will cause an overgrowth of connective tissue in the liver that compresses the bile ducts. So that compression leads to obstruction, and it has more bilirubin in the vascular system, which will result in the yellowish discoloration. Skin lesions. This is due to the increase in circulating estrogen due to the inability of the liver to metabolize steroid hormones. So the liver can't metabolize what it needs to. So all those other different hormones that have to be metabolized, they're just floating around. So the patient will have spider angiomas and pulmonary erythema. With hematologic disorders, because we know the liver is responsible for helping with clotting, so they'll develop thrombocytopenia, leukopenia, anemia. And all of this is a result from the backed up blood causing splenomegaly from the portal hypertension, and that large spleen is going to cause red blood cells to be removed from the circulation. So with the patient having issues with their clotting factors, of course, the patient is going to have bleeding tendencies. Endocrine problems. So they'll have decreased metabolism of those hormones again. So men will have gynecomastia, loss of axillary and pubic hair, testicular atrophy, impotence and loss of libido, and women will have amenorrhea or vaginal bleeding. Peripheral neuropathy is a common finding in alcoholic cirrhosis because of dietary deficiencies of thiamine, folic acid, and cobalamin. So that's why liver patients are placed on thiamine and folic acid vitamins. Complications of cirrhosis. So patients who are cirrhotic but who have no obvious complications, that is compensated cirrhosis. One or more complications of liver disease is decompensated cirrhosis. So we'll talk about a few of those. But the first thing is portal hypertension. And like I mentioned earlier, this is just elevated blood pressure in their portal circulation. So the way the portal circulation works, the portal venous system will drain blood from the stomach, intestines, pancreas, and spleen into the liver through the portal vein. With cirrhosis having that extra scar tissue and it altering the blood flow through the portal vein, of course, this is going to cause an increase in that pressure. So the body tries to compensate for that pressure by diverting the blood flow into the other veins. So remember how we talked about with CAD, how the heart can get overwhelmed and it starts to develop collateral circulation. So the same applies here. So the liver will develop collateral circulation, and that extra blood flow makes the veins expand and makes their walls stretch, and it causes them to become more weak. So with those weakened walls being stretched out, it can cause fluids to leak back into abdomen, and they can break and bleed. So that's how we come to esophageal and gastric varices. So these varices, they're fragile, and they don't tolerate the high pressure, which makes them bleed easily. So the patient may have melanoma or hematemesis. And ruptured esophageal varices, this is the most life-threatening complication of cirrhosis and is considered a medical emergency. Peripheral edema. So this is just edema that occurs in the lower extremities and the presacral area. and it can occur before, concurrently, or after ascites. So ascites is another form of edema. So this is the most common manifestation of cirrhosis. Several mechanisms can lead to ascites. So with portal hypertension, the proteins will shift from those blood vessels. Remember how we just discussed about the walls of those vessels weakening and causing fluid to leak. So that leakage of fluid into that peritoneal cavity can lead to ascites. Hypoalbuminemia, so this is decreased albumin levels. The liver can't synthesize it, so this decreases colloidal oncotic pressure. Hyperaldosteronism, so those damaged hepatocytes can't synthesize aldosterone, increasing those, having more sodium to be reabsorbed from those aldosterone levels. And this will cause water retention and edema, and of course, high blood pressure. Hepatic encephalopathy. So this is a neuropsychiatric manifestation of liver disease. It includes neurotoxic effects of ammonia, abnormal neurotransmission, astrocyte swelling, and inflammatory cytokines. So major sources of ammonia, the bacteria and enzymatic breakdown of amino acids in the intestines. So originally, once it's broken down, it's supposed to go to the liver and be converted to urea and excreted by the kidneys. But with having an impaired liver, this causes more ammonia levels to be out in the systemic circulation. And those extra ammonia levels floating out there can cross the blood-brain barrier and cause these neurological manifestations. So the manifestations include changes in neurologic and mental responsiveness, impaired consciousness, inappropriate behavior, sleep disturbances, trouble concentrating, coma, asterixis. So asterixis is a flapping tremor in the arms and hands. So you can pretty much tell your patient to stick their hands out, and it's like their hands are going to flapping along with their arms. So with this asterixis, they'll have issues with writing. So they can't move the pen from left to right. So they have apraxia. And foetor hepaticus, this is a musty, sweet odor of the patient's breath. So with hepatorenal syndrome, the cause of this condition is just a complex from other things. So, for example, portal hypertension with liver decompensation. This will result in the splanchnic and systemic vasodilation and decreased arterial blood volume. And it will cause the renal system to start vasoconstricting, and that's how the failure will appear. So this can be a result of diuretic therapy, GI bleeding, and paracentesis in cirrhosis adults. So with the liver panel, of course we know that all of those labs are going to be initially high due to the release from the inflamed liver cells. But in end-stage cirrhosis, AST and ALT are normal. Protein and albumin levels will be low. Bilirubin, globulin, and PT will be elevated. And cholesterol levels can also be low. Same applies with our patient with cirrhosis. We need them to rest because of the increase in metabolic needs. We're going to be giving them B-complex vitamins. We need them to avoid alcohol and minimize the use or complete avoidance of aspirin, acetaminophen, and NSAIDs. The liver can't metabolize those drugs, so we definitely don't want them taking those and they're just building up in their system. With ascites, our focus needs to be on sodium restrictions. So we want to limit them to at least 2 grams per day of sodium. We carefully need to monitor fluid and electrolyte imbalances so we can give albumin infusions to help maintain their volume. Diuretics, they usually like to do combo drugs because it's more effective that way. So they may be on a potassium sparing diuretic and a loop diuretic. So examples are spironolactone, amiloride, triamcerin, furosemide, and tolvaptan. Tolvaptan, that's a vasopressin receptor agonist that they may put them on. So if the fluids get if the fluid gets bad enough where we need to draw it off, of course they are going to do a paracentesis where they draw off that fluid, but it's only if needed. Esophageal and gastric varices. So we want to prevent bleeding and rupture by reducing that portal pressure, because we know that pressure is what causes the bleeding to start. So our patients need to avoid alcohol, aspirin, and NSAIDs again. So patients with cirrhosis, they should have already have had an EGD to assess the presence of those varices. So usually they like to start them on a non-selective beta blocker. So nitinol or propranolol are the choices. And this just helps reduce the risk of the hemorrhage and rupture by decreasing their portal pressure. If bleeding were to occur, we need to stabilize the patient and of course manage their airway. So we need to start IV therapy and blood products as soon as possible. Drug therapy for bleeding is octreotide or vasopressin or an endoscopy. So during the endoscopy, they can go in and do either a band ligation or sclerotherapy. So band ligation is just when they put a rubber band around the base of the varix, which is the enlarged vein. And sclerotherapy is where they go in and inject a sclerorizing agent in that swollen vein. And that just helps prevent rebleeding. If endoscopy does not work, the next step would be the balloon tamponade. So this is mechanical compression of those varices. So they have several types of tubes that are used that has multiple lumens, and each lumen on the balloon should be labeled, and it has to be secured to prevent occlusion of the airway. If your patient has one of these balloons, they must be deflated every 8 to 12 hours to prevent tissue from becoming necrotic. Another procedure is the TIPS procedure, which is the transjugular intrahepatic portal systemic shunt. So this is done whenever they have had a second major bleeding episode. So this is a non-surgical procedure in which a tract shunt is placed between the systemic and portal venous system, and it just helps to redirect that portal blood flow. So they'll have either a portal cable or a distal splenal renal shunt, and they have pics of that on page 986, figure 43.9. With hepatic encephalopathy, of course we know it's from increased ammonia levels, so we need to reduce that ammonia from forming, and the most common drug to give for this is lactulose. So lactulose will trap that ammonia in the gut where it belongs, and we put them on rifaximin for an antibiotic treatment. So with our patients with this that are being given lactulose, of course they're going to be having consistent bowel movements. So we want to prevent constipation. We don't want them to become constipated. We want them to have those bowel movements. So we need to lower protein intake with the diet, control GI bleeding, because we know with the bleeding and the ammonia levels, it does not help. And we want to remove that blood from the GI tract because that can cause ammonia to multiply. Nutritional therapy. They're going to be on a high calorie diet. We want them getting at least 3,000 calories a day, high carbohydrates, and moderate to low fat. Implementations for cirrhosis, so nutritional needs. We want them to do oral hygiene before meals because this helps improve their taste sensation. Because remember, everything is kind of distasteful to them. So make sure that they have snacks available between meals, and we want to offer preferred foods if possible. But it has to be ones that are within their dietary restrictions. So we also need to make sure that we're educating the patient and the family on things that they can and cannot eat. If jaundice is present, we need to know where it is and if they have pruritus along with it, so that itching. We can give them colistiramine or hydroxyzine. That helps with the itching. We can also offer baking soda or alpha cure baths, where they use bath oils to help with skin issues. We can offer lotions that have calamine in it. We want them on soft or old linen. Temperature control. We don't want them getting too hot or too cold. Short nails, and if they need to scratch, we want them to rub with their knuckles. If jaundice is present, expect their urine to be dark brown and their stool to be either gray or tan. For ascites and edema, of course, with it being fluid overload, we're going to make sure that we're getting an accurate intake and output on these patients. We want to get daily weights and measurements of the abdomen and the extremities. For paracentesis, we want the patient to void immediately before this procedure. We want them in a high foulish position or sitting on the side of the bed afterwards. We are taking fluids off with the paracentesis, so of course we want to monitor for hypovolemia and electrolyte imbalances. So we can keep up with that by watching blood pressure, heart rate, and also we need to pay attention to the dressing that's applied to that puncture site. So we don't want them bleeding or leaking out any more fluid after being stuck. As far as skin care, we want them on a special mattress, so and make sure that they're on a turning schedule. Range of motion exercises. We will also want to do cough and deep breathing exercises because all that fluid can cause some issues with their breathing. If scrotal edema is present, we need to elevate the scrotal sac. So we usually like to get like a pillowcase and kind of like put it up under there and kind of elevate it by putting like a little rolled up face towel up under it as well. So with varices, we need to observe for signs of bleeding, so melena and hematemesis. With the balloon tamponade, we need to be sure to educate the patient and family about the balloon. We need to check for patency and position, which is verified by X-ray. We also want to monitor for complications. So with these balloons being inflated, and it's usually either through the nasal or was of course it's inserted through the nasal cavity, but it goes down in the esophagus. This can cause the esophagus to rupture or have erosion, or they can have regurgitation or aspiration of gastric contents, or the most important, it can occlude their airway. So with varices, we need to keep the scissors at the bedside. If the gastric balloon breaks or is deflated and obstructs the airway, we need to cut the tube and deflate that other balloon because we don't want them to lose their airway. With hepatic encephalopathy, we need to assess level of consciousness, monitor fluid and electrolyte imbalances, making sure that they're responding to the treatment, assessing their neuro status every 2 hours, and we definitely want to prevent falls and injuries with them being out of it. Talk about acute pancreatitis. So the pathophysiology of acute pancreatitis is caused by autodigestion of pancreas. So the causative factors injure the pancreatic cells or they activate the pancreatic enzymes in the pancreas instead of the intestine. So this causes trypsinogen to be activated. So trypsinogen activates to trypsin within the pancreas, and this is what leads to bleeding. So with acute pancreatitis, it can be classified as either mild or severe. If it's mild, they'll have edematous or interstitial pancreatitis, but if it's severe, it could be necrotizing. They can have endocrine and exocrine dysfunction. They can have necrosis, organ failure, or even sepsis. Main manifestation of acute pancreatitis is abdominal pain. And this is due to the distension of the pancreas, peritoneal irritation, and obstruction of the biliary tract. So we have the different other manifestations listed, but let's talk specifically about Gray's Turner's and colon signs. So these are a result of seepage of blood stain exudate from the pancreas. So if the pancreas starts to bleed, they will start to appear on the skin. So with Gray Turner's, they'll have bluish discoloration on the flanks. With colon sign, they'll have bluish periumbilical discoloration. So these patients, they can develop shock from the hemorrhage of the pancreas, toxemia from the pancreatic enzymes, or hypovolemia from the fluid shift into the retroperitoneal space. So, of course, there are complications that can result from acute pancreatitis. So, pancreatic pseudocysts, this is just fluid, pancreatic enzyme, tissue debris, and inflammatory exudates surrounded by a wall next to the pancreas. So, the patient will have abdominal pain, they'll have a palpable mass, nausea, vomiting, and anorexia. So, it's most commonly detected by imaging, so CT, MRI, or an endoscopic ultrasound. The pseudocyst can either resolve on its own or it'll perforate and cause peritonitis. So in this case, we'll have to do surgical treatment or percutaneous or endoscopic drainage of that fluid from that pseudocyst. Pancreatic abscess, they'll have upper abdominal pain, a palpable mass, high fever, leukocytosis, and they'll need prompt surgical drainage to prevent sepsis because, of course, the abscess is infectious. The patients can also have systemic complications from acute pancreatitis. So pulmonary complications, they're a result of that exudate with pancreatic enzymes being passed through the transdiaphragmatic lymph channels. So that leakage of that fluid from the pancreas can actually get into that lymph, into those lymph channels and travel to the lungs and cause lung issues. So whenever trypsin activates prothrombin and plasminogen, this places the patient at risk for thrombi-PE and DIC. Hypertension from fluid shifts and sepsis and fat necrosis can cause calcium and fatty acids to combine, which will cause tetany, which is a part of hypocalcemia. The lab values specific for acute pancreatitis, be sure to know these. So table 43.18 on page 994 talks about them. So primary lab tests to help determine pancreatitis are your serum lipase and amylase. And of course, they're both gonna be increased. So evaluation is determined at finding the cause of the acute pancreatitis. So we can do an abdominal ultrasound, x-ray, CT scan, which a CT is going to be your best imaging test for pancreatitis and complications. And we can also do an endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography, which is ERCP. So our interprofessional care for acute pancreatitis. So some of our conservative therapy, we want to make sure that pain is managed properly. So we can give them IV opioids, analgesics with antispasmodic agents, and other meds that can help relax those smooth muscles, which are nitroglycerin or papaverin. For shock, if it's present, we want to give them plasma or plasma volume expanders, such as dextran or albumin. If they develop fluid and electrolyte problems, we can give LR or electrolyte solutions that can help with the corrections and maintain central venous pressure. So we can also hook them up to, if they have a central line, so that we can get central venous pressure readings, because that'll help us determine fluid needs as well. With shock, if they have hypertension, we can give them vasoactive drugs such as dopamine, and that'll help increase the systemic vascular resistance. And as far as metabolic complications, so we need to maintain their oxygen saturation greater than 95%, and we want to monitor for signs of hyperglycemia. So this is why they're going to be on sliding scale insulin. Pancreatic secretions, we need to reduce or suppress the enzymes because that helps decrease stimulation of the pancreas. So we do this by maintaining the patient at an NPO status. So the patient needs NPO. We can insert an NG tube and hook it up to suction. That'll help decrease acid secretion. And we can also give medications to help suppress acid production as well. If need be, the patient can be placed on enteral nutrition to give them the proper nutrition that they'll need. We want to prevent and treat infection. So for necrotic pancreatic tissue, It causes bacteria to be able to grow, which will lead to them being infected. So this is why enteral nutrition is the best and safest choice, because it reduces necrotizing pancreatitis. We should also start them on antibiotics to help prevent necrotizing as well. Antibiotic choice can be narrowed down by either endoscopy or CT-guided percutaneous aspiration. We need to remove the precipitating cause that's causing the pancreatitis. So if it's gallstones, we can do an ERCP plus endoscopic sphincterotomy or a laparoscopic cholecystectomy. For nutritional therapy, whenever they're allowed to intake food, we want to give them small, frequent feedings. We want them on a high carbohydrate diet, and if they're not tolerating the oral food, start to look for these signs. So they'll have pain, increase in abdominal girth, or increased amylase and lipase levels. So at that point, the patient needs to go back to being NPO, and NG tube needs to be placed again, or if it's still in, it needs to be hooked back up to suction. No alcohol whatsoever. And also, we'll be giving them supplemental fat-soluble vitamins. So acute care with acute pancreatitis. Want to make sure that we're monitoring our vital signs. So for looking for hypotension, fever, or tachypnea. With them having issues with fluid and electrolyte balances, focusing on certain electrolytes, so chloride, sodium, and potassium, because they can have frequent vomiting, and of course, gastric suction that we'll have them hooked up to. They can have hypocalcemia where they develop tetany, so we have to give them calcium gluconate to treat that. And they can also have hypomagnesemia. With respiratory function, we need to assess the lung sounds and O2 saturation. And if ARDS develops from acute pancreatitis, we need to intubate and get them on the ventilator. For pain, giving them opioids, making sure we promote comfortable positioning and frequent position changes. So certain positions that can help with pain management, they can flex the tr their trunk and draw their knees to their abdomen. Or we can place them in sideline with the head of the bed at 45 degrees. Those two positions can help alleviate pain. Oral and nasal care. Because they can have dryness of the nose and mouth, especially if they have an NG tube in place and they're NPO. So we can use mouth moisturizer or swabbing their mouth with a swab that's soaked in some ice water. Antacids. If they're able to take something by mouth, we want them to sip it slowly. Or we could place it down the NG tube. So chronic pancreatitis. This is usually caused by alcohol, gallstones, tumor, pseudocyst, trauma, systemic disease, autoimmune pancreatitis, or cystic fibrosis. There are two major types. Obstructive, this is inflammation of the sphincter of Oddi. Or they can have cancer of the ampulla of Vater, or cancer of the duodenum or pancreas. If it's non-obstructive, it's a result of inflammation and sclerosis in the head of the pancreas and around duct, and that one is more commonly caused by alcohol abuse. With chronic pancreatitis, they have the same abdominal pain and is located in the same area as acute pancreatitis. They're going to have heavy gnawing, feeling burning, and cramp-like pain, and it's more frequent until it's almost constant. They have similar complications, so they can have a pseudocyst to form, they can have bile duct or duodenal obstruction, pancreatic ascites, pleural effusions, splenic vein thrombosis, pseudoaneurysms, or pancreatic cancer. Now, as far as laboratory values with chronic pancreatitis, the amylase and lipase may be slightly increased or it may be normal. It may not have any discrepancies at all. But of course, their bilirubin alkaline phosphatase, they're going to be increased, they'll have mild leukocytosis, and they'll have an increased sedimentation rate. So steatorrhea, which is a manifestation of chronic pancreatitis, we know that that's fatty stool. So we need to get a stool sample and test it for fat content. The secretin stimulation test, this can assess the degree of the pancreatic dysfunction, so how well or not it's working. Care for patients with chronic pancreatitis, we want them to take frequent doses of analgesics to help them reach proper pain management. So these patients may be prescribed a fentanyl patch or PO morphine to be prescribed for the pain. If they're going to be on a diet, we want them on small and frequent, bland, low-fat diets. We usually put them on pancreatic enzyme products. So pancrelipase is the most common one. And this just helps replace those deficient enzymes that are missing. This should be given with meals, snacks, and we need to teach the patient to monitor their stool for steatorrhea. This helps determine its effectiveness. So if they're taking this, they should not have steatorrhea at all. We give bile salts to help prevent further fat loss. And they're going to be on acid neutralizing or inhibiting drugs to help control that gastric acidity, because that acid is what's going to cause that pancreatitis to flare up. They can be started on antidepressants for neuropathic pain. And surgery is indicated if biliary disease is present or if obstruction or pseudocyst develops. So all these different types of surgical procedure just diverts the bile flow or relieves the ductal obstruction. So I'm going to talk about the two common gallbladder diseases, cholelithiasis and cholecystitis. So when remembering the risk factors for gallbladder disease, think about the four Fs: female, fertile, fat, and 40. Pregnant women are also at risk for gallbladder disease. Postmenopausal women on estrogen replacement therapy and younger women on oral contraceptives are also at an increased risk for developing gallbladder disease. Cholelithiasis. So this is any time a condition upsets the balance, and it includes infection and changes in the way cholesterol is metabolized. So supersaturated bile is called lithogenic bile. So the bile that's secreted by the liver becomes lithogenic. So stasis of that bile will lead to supersaturation and changes in the composition of the bile. And that's how we get the biliary sludge. So stones, they can either stay in the gallbladder or they may migrate to the cystic or common bile duct, causing pain as they pass through those ducts. And they may lodge in those ducts and cause an obstruction. So other components of bile that can precipitate into stones are bile salts, bilirubin, calcium, and protein. Mixed cholesterol are the most common types of gallstones. Immobility, pregnancy, because of the hormonal factors that cause delayed emptying of the gallbladder in pregnancy. And inflammatory or obstructive lesions in the biliary system are reasons that can decrease that bile from flowing. With cholecystitis, a calculus cholecystitis is a condition that develops in older adults and critically ill patients that have prolonged immobility, if they've been fasting, if they've had prolonged parenteral nutrition, and diabetes. And the main cause of this type is biliary stasis. So other risk factors include adhesions, cancer, anesthesia, and opioids. With cholecystitis, inflammation is going to be your major pathophysiologic condition. So that inflammation is confined to the mucus lining of their gallbladder or the entire wall. So during an attack, the gallbladder is edematous and hyperemic, and it could be distended with bile or pus. So then that cystic duct will become occluded and it'll start to have some scarring and fibrosis that'll appear. So the manifestations of gallbladder disease. So we've already talked about how inflammation is the key factor with cholecystitis. So they can have leukocytosis in and may be accompanied with a fever along with these signs and symptoms. So physical assessment findings, they're going to have right upper quadrant or epigastrium tenderness and abdominal rigidity. Usually the pain will start to occur after a high fat meal or whenever the patient lies down. So with total obstruction is discussed on table 43.22, and it just talks about how if they have complete obstruction, the difference in the manifestations and what it'll look like. With chronic cholecystitis, these patients have fat intolerance, dyspepsia, heartburn, and flatulence. Complications of cholecystitis. So cholangitis, that's just inflammation of the biliary ducts, and cholelithiasis is just where they have a stone in the common bile duct. So our lab values for gallbladder disease. Of course, the white count's going to be elevated due to the inflammation. Their serum bilirubin and urinary bilirubin is going to be increased. Their liver enzyme is going to be increased because of the blockage, and their serum amylase may be increased as well. So now we're going to talk about the professional care of a patient with gallbladder disease. So of course, we have our most common topics listed on the conservative therapy, but I'm going to start with the transhepatic biliary catheter. So this is a catheter that can be inserted preoperatively or for palliative care if the patient has an inoperable liver, pancreatic, or bile duct cancers that obstruct the bile flow, and we need to get that bile from out of there. So it's inserted percutaneously. The catheter is connected to a drainage bag. So whenever these catheters are placed, we want to encourage the patient to replace those fluids that are being lost with electrolyte-rich drinks, so Gatorades, Powerades. So with this catheter, we want to make sure that we're observing for bile leakage because bile can burn the skin. ERCP with sphincterotomy. So we can do that procedure to remove the stones and place stents to prevent stones from collecting in those ducts again. The extracorporeal shockwave lithotripsy. So this is shockwave therapy that's done whenever ERCP fails. So a lithotripser uses high energy shockwaves to help break those stones up, and this usually takes about 1 to 2 hours. So surgical therapy. Of course, your most common is your lap chole. That's a treatment of choice. So the removal of the gallbladder, is taken out through 1 to 4 punct. They'll have 1 to 4 puncture holes. They have minimal post-op pain. They can resume normal activities, including work, within a week. And they have fewer complications. These lap choles, because they use CO2 gas to help inflate the abdomen, it can cause some patient discomfort. So they may have referred pain to the shoulder from that CO2. So we can put them in Sims position to help them move that gas. Also, we can do deep breathing exercises. We want them ambulating to help move that gas, and of course, giving them analgesia for pain management. And incisional open cholecystectomy. So this one is more serious. The incision, of course, is bigger. The gallbladder is removed through a right subcostal incision. And they can place what's called a T-tube into the common bile duct. So they only do place a T-tube when a bile duct exploration is necessary during surgery. And so this just ensures that duct ensures the patency of the duct until the edema and trauma from the surgery goes down. And it just allows the bile to be able to drain while the small intestine adjusts to the receiving continuous flow of the bile. So with the open chole, that's a bigger incision, so we want to prevent respiratory complications. So splinting that incision can help with deep breathing, and we want to maintain adequate ventilation. So your patients are not going to want to take deep breaths with this type of incision, but it's our job to encourage them to. So I have two pictures on here showing examples of the T-tube placement and how it looks. So with T-tube maintenance, we want to maintain the system and monitor the functioning drainage of it. So it's usually connected to a closed gravity drainage system. And if large amounts are draining, we want to make sure that we're using a sterile pouching system to protect that skin. And we want to encourage the patient to replace any lost fluids and electrolytes as well with the T-tube insertion. Nutritional therapy. So of course the same applies. We want them on small frequent meals with a little bit of fat, not too much. We want them to have a high fiber diet and taking in some calcium. If they're obese, we want to do reduced calories. Ways to prevent it, we want to avoid rapid weight loss because that can cause gallbladder flare-ups prior to having gallbladder disease. So after lap colies, we do liquids first and then we graduate to light meals for the next few days. And then if we do incisional, liquids first, then a regular diet once the bowel sounds have returned. So with an incisional, we may need to restrict fats for at least 4 to 6 weeks.